Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Good Shepherd Manor versus City of Moment. Mr. Whalen.
May it please the court. Martin, Mr. Elliott. We're here because in the district court, the district judge McCluskey denied the plaintiff Good Shepherd Manor the opportunity to present a case of reasonable under the Fair Housing Act under the provisions of the reasonable accommodation or the disparate impact or effect. He limited us to proof only of intentional discrimination. We believe that was error, since the law, the case, both the case law and the statute provide that case under the Fair Housing Act and under the Americans with Disabilities Act can be proven by not only proof of intent or direct discrimination, but also proof of a failure to provide a reasonable accommodation. Good Shepherd Manor provides it's a not-for-profit corporation that provides housing for disabled adult residents. The adults suffer from developmental disabilities such as cerebral palsy, seizure disorder, autism. They are generally in the lower 3% of the population. The state of Illinois mandated that Good Shepherd move its residents, of which there were 120, from a shelter care or a dormitory or barracks type situation into group homes under a less restrictive environment scenario. The group homes began to be built in 1995. In 1999, and as part of the, I should mention, as part of the process, the permits were issued by the County of Kankakee. Good Shepherd is an unincorporated Kankakee County. The City of Moment's involvement was only with the water connection. The water line was brought up in 1995 and extended to the houses, and again in 1997 when additional houses were built. In 1999, Good Shepherd wanted to build two additional group homes. On a piece of property it purchased immediately to the north of the property, illustrated the plan Exhibit 1, which is the trial record. The property is directly north of Good Shepherd's property. The Jehovah's Witnesses bought a 5-acre parcel of property immediately to the north of Good Shepherd's property. The City of Moment asked Good Shepherd to accommodate the Jehovah Witnesses by extending the water and sewer line from the existing facilities which were to be built to the property line. Good Shepherd said that they would if Jehovah Witnesses paid their proportionate share. Good Shepherd wasn't about to give the property away. It wasn't about to do it for nothing.
Why not?
Because it didn't have to. There was no requirement that we extend the water line.
When you say, because it didn't have to, is that strictly your view as a matter of federal law? You think federal law excuses you from complying with rules of state and local law?
No, there was no state or local law which required us to extend the line.
Well, then why aren't you in state court?
Because this is a Fair Housing Act case.
All right. We have to assume then that a state rule requires property owner A to extend the water line to the next place, or equivalently in local practice, you have to put in your own sidewalks, and there are all sorts of things that states require for new buildings, right? And that leads then to the question whether Good Shepherd bore any more expense as a result of the fact that it was building housing for the disabled than it would have if it were building an apartment block.
And there is nothing in this record that shows that Good Shepherd had that there was any city requirement to do it.
No,
other
no.
than
look, there are two things you could be arguing. One is there's no such requirement under city law. In that event, there's no need to be here. You'd be in state court. You'd be arguing that the city has exceeded its local powers. The only way you can be here, the only logical way you can be here, is if the city has a valid requirement that won't extend the water line to the property, and you think federal law preempts that.
The city argued that we had an obligation because we submitted a site plan, that we had an obligation to extend. So that would be, I guess, the city's position, that there was a requirement that we do it visa by virtue of our site plan that we submitted. Of course, the site plan that was submitted, said by others, that there was a and it shows clearly it was by others.
The residents, the houses were built to code. Everything was up to code. The residents were ready to move in. The water was connected. The city turned it off.
Did you enter into an agreement with the city to provide an easement across your property?
The easement ran with the water line if it was extended. The agreement with the city is I'm not sure the city's the party to the agreement, and that's part of the problem here. They asked us to accommodate the Jehovah Witnesses, who we said we'd do it if they agreed to pay a proportionate share of the cost. We couldn't come to an agreement with them. We extended the water line only to our resident. The city stepped in on behalf of them, turned the water off, and wouldn't turn it back on because they claimed they would lose their leverage over the situation. In other words, they wanted us all of a sudden to provide the water to Jehovah Witnesses for nothing. And we said we didn't have to do it. We asked for an accommodation. We'll put up the cost of extending the line, and pending a determination of who's responsible for extending the line. We saw no harm to the city in that. The city just absolutely refused to even discuss it, figuring they had a very valuable pawn here and 16 disabled men, and that Good Shepherd would go ahead and do it. We didn't do it. We went ahead and sued and brought this case. So. Well, one of the theories was...
I guess get back to the question is, did you offer to provide an easement, or did you indicate that an easement would be provided?
We indicated an easement would be provided if the water line was extended. We had no intention of giving the city an easement on a piece of property that there wasn't a water line. In fact, the record is very clear when the easement issues came up. We tendered easements to the city for the water lines as built. They refused to accept it, saying... We had to extend it and give them an easement for the.
Well, what if the Seventh-day Adventists weren't ready for the water line and it would be put in at a different time?
It wasn't the city that was doing it. The agreement was with the accommodation to the Jehovah Witnesses.
You're negotiating with Jehovah's Witnesses or with the city?
We're negotiating with Jehovah Witnesses. The city wasn't going to pay for this in any way, shape, or form.
Well, I understand.
That's why
that.
There's no burden to them.
Did you submit that plat for approval, which had on it an indication of an easement?
It had an indication of an easement, but our position is the easement is by others, the same as the water and sewer line. We were not intending to give them an easement over on our property if somebody wasn't going to pay for it. We consider that to be a taking. If they can't require us to dedicate it.
Somebody's going to pay you for the easement?
Somebody's going to pay us for the water and sewer line, yes. Connection and the use and the loss of the property.
I must have missed this. So when you submitted this, the intention was you would receive compensation for providing the easement?
For the compensation for providing the whole package, the water, the sewer line, and the easement. We're giving up part of our property. The easement goes in once the water and sewer line is there. It's a maintenance easement. That's our understanding. We weren't there giving an easement for the city to allow somebody to connect at a future time.
So it was only a maintenance easement, not general easement.
That's our position. That's our position. And that was something that was never explored, you know, under either a reasonable accommodation analysis. The trial court didn't allow the reasonable accommodation analysis just prior to trial. It relied on the Hemisphere and Brand cases decided by this court, which we think are, you know, totally present a totally different factual situation than presented by this case. the those cases were zoning cases where developers wanted to build housing suitable for disabled adults and residents, and in order to make more money, put more houses on the property, they'd be able to make more money under the saying that the housing for the disabled would be less expensive. Here we have housing that was built only for the handicapped. There was no other purpose for this house. By denying the water, you in effect denied them the housing. And in our position, the reasonable accommodation analysis should have been allowed to proceed. We proved that the accommodation was necessary for the men to live. They don't have any other choices where to live. This is highly beneficial housing. The evidence of the benefits to the residents was overwhelming and uncontroverted. The level of benefits, the privacy, having their own room as opposed to living in a dormitory, the levels of funding, these were all benefits that were denied to them because of the city, really on an ad hoc basis, turned off the water.
Was that because they were disabled or handicapped?
I don't think we have to reach that determination. That's the determination we don't have to reach because it's under a reasonable accommodation analysis, their rationale, which may be relevant in a direct discrimination case, and that's how they defended the case, it may be relevant to there, but in the reasonable accommodation case, they have, after we prove it's reasonable and necessary, they have the burden of proving that somehow it's unreasonable or too expensive or burdensome to them. Their intent is not the issue under the reasonable accommodation analysis.
So it doesn't make any difference whether anybody is handicapped or whether it's just happened to be a subdivision unrelated to any disability.
Well, if they weren't handicapped, there wouldn't be any reasonable accommodation analysis. Because they were handicapped, the law provides that they have the right to a reasonable accommodation to allow them to live in that type of housing, and they were denied that. Our remedy was take that to its logical conclusion, and any irrational act they do, as long as they say it wasn't because of a handicap, allows them to deny the handicap the right to the housing. That's why they have the reasonable accommodation provision in the statute that provides a second element to it. Not only is it intentional, the Dadian case, the Economowoc case, those cases have all held that you can prove discrimination either way. The failure to reasonably accommodate is intentional because your reasonable and foreseeable consequences of your act follow from what you did. You didn't accommodate them. You intentionally didn't accommodate them. So intentional in the form of direct discrimination is really not the analysis under the reasonable accommodation. However, that's what we were limited to in the district court, and that's where we think the error is.
Mr. Whalen, what are the limits of the principle you advance? Would any zoning decision by a governmental unit which impacts the convenience and use of a facility that's for the disabled in effect be failure to reasonably accommodate?
No. As this court has held, certain zoning ordinances aren't. But if you analyze them under the reasonable accommodation analysis, there's a test. If it's not a reasonable request, then you lose. If there's an undue or financial burden to the defendant, then it's not a reasonable accommodation.
What we actually said in Brandt is that this statute applies to local rules that are more expensive for disabled persons than for non-disabled persons. Is this a local rule that is more expensive for disabled than non-disabled persons?
It's not more expensive, but it denies them the housing. It's a local rule, in this case, albeit an ad hoc rule, that denied them the housing. I don't think there's anything in the statute that says it only applies to things that are expensive. It applies to the denial of the housing. Lastly, tied into that was the district court's denial of the Good Shepherd's use of the expert of Professor Susan Connors as an expert witness, which
sort of really dovetails into the reasonable accommodation analysis from our point of view. If the case proceeded under a reasonable accommodation analysis, her opinions on the reasonableness and the applicability of the city's restrictions or their requirements would have been relevant. We believe that we had the right to prove discrimination in three ways. We were limited to one. We believe that was error, and we think this court should remand the case to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whalen. Mr. Martin.
Please the court. Counsel. I'm John Martin. I represent the defendant appellee, City of Moments, the mayor, and the alderman of that city. The situation here is an unfortunate one. It represents hopefully a single episode in a long history of getting along with Good Shepherd and by the City of Moments over the years, as we describe in our brief. We've cooperated with them, and each and every time they've come to us for help in building new houses, in extending water and sewer, in areas where we don't have to, but we do it, and we've done it over the years to help them out. We've given them variances on our zoning when they had a house in town. This situation arose because what they said they would do, they didn't do, and that's what caused the problem.
This matter went to trial, am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the evidence with regard to what they would do that... What's your position?
Okay.
Your point said it was just a maintenance. They only agreed to a maintenance easement.
No, it's more than that. It's a public utility easement, and that's what's shown on their drawing that they gave us. They came to us because they bought this parcel, which is outside the city, wanted to build some more houses, and we said, sure. As before, they brought site plans, like this is one of them. They brought us various site plans over the course of a year and a half, and all of them had these easements in there. They went all the way to the north property line. And that's important because the Jehovah's Witnesses have bought the land to the north of that. They want to connect on, and other people too. And so the city is interested in developing all of this for these people who want to do that. So we helped them. We signed the applications for their EPA permits. We agreed to provide water and sewer service to them. And so the project went along. At the very end of the project, in April 2001, the buildings were not done. They were almost done, but not done. And we learned that they were not putting in the water and sewer lines like they said they were going to. And even more important for us is that they then changed their minds and said, we're not going to give you the easement all the way to the north line. It's going to stop in the middle of their property. And it was at this point that the city took the step to shut the water off. Now, the water had been turned on at the request of the contractor. Nobody's lived in the houses at that point. In fact, there's testimony from the county inspector that nothing... as far as the water, delayed anything as far as this house, but that they were not ready for occupancy yet. That's how this situation came up. Our position was they said they'd do this, at least the easements, and then they didn't. And it was only at the very end that they said, we're not going to give you the easements now. If you look on this exhibit which they've put up here, and there's testimony about this, is PUE, public utility easement, is shown on here. You can see that it's written right on their plan. And the engineers testified, both their engineer and the city engineer testified that means public utility easement. And as this diagram shows, it was to go all the way to the north property line. That's what caused the problem as far as we were concerned. Our position is we didn't take any action because these men were handicapped. If any developer, and there's testimony of this in the record too, if any developer came, gave us plans, then didn't build them in according to what they said they'd do, we would do some action similar to this. It had nothing to do with the men being disabled. We feel that the reasonable accommodation theory does not apply to the case, and as Judge McCuskey stated, the action we took was not by reason of their handicap, and it was done solely by virtue of what these men have in common with the general population, the need for water. It was nothing geared toward their disability. The Conemaugh case, for example, there was a code required that there be 2,500 feet between houses for disabled people, something that's directed right at disabled people. This was just a requirement an action we took, and it wouldn't have mattered who it was, whether it was disabled or not.
Mr. Martin, this would be for the water for the new construction, right?
Yes, sir.
It wouldn't affect the water for the existing residents?
Absolutely not, no. There's all the other houses that they've built that we've provided water and sewer to. It's sewer easements also, not just water. They all have had uninterrupted service. We didn't take any action against that part. It was just this one new project. Or there are other, they have another building out there, too, which we provide water and sewer service to. We think that our case is like the Hemisphere building and the Brandt cases. As far as reasonable accommodation, the duty, I think this court said, the duty of reasonable accommodation is confined to rules and practices that hurt handicapped people by reason of their handicap. And I don't think there's any evidence here that that's what happened here. And I think it's like Brandt, it's like Hemisphere building, it's unlike a cottage block where the code which was being challenged was one that was specifically aimed at housing for disabled people and was restricting where they could be put. There's nothing that was done here that was done out of hostility to the handicap, and I think that's what Judge McCuskey found. And without that duty, then there is no reasonable accommodation requirement. It's a predicate. First you decide whether the action was taken because of the disability or because of what they have in common with other people. I think then if you reach that point, then you go on to whether there's a reasonable accommodation or not. When they talk about reasonable accommodation, in the brief, they talk about their proposal that they're going to give us $10,000 to escrow, and that's, I guess, that, and then we would turn the water on. That was, I think, is what they're saying is reasonable accommodation. Now, I don't think that is a reasonable accommodation. I would say the city did not just say, you know, absolute denial. What the mayor said to them was, if you'll finish this project, as you said, within 60 days, we'll turn it on right now. But the plaintiffs didn't want to do that. So eventually ended up in court, obviously. The issue regarding Susan Connor, I think the trial court was correct in not letting her testify. They tried to characterize the case that we made it a land use case, so they should have been able to put the testimony in from Professor Connor. I don't dispute that they should be able to put in evidence trying to refute what we're saying as to the reasons why we did what we did, but this particular evidence is totally improper, and I think that's what the trial court was correct when he ruled that way. We had a report from her, her deposition was taken, it was placed in the record. Her testimony was that she is an attorney, she was hired to review the situation here, and if she could testify at trial, her intention was to testify as an expert witness, an expert legal witness, that the city violated the Fair Housing Amendment Act. Her testimony was going to be that the city violated Illinois case law that governs planning and zoning. Her testimony was going to be the city violated the Illinois Municipal Code. Her testimony was going to be that we may have violated the United States Constitution under the Taking Clause. These are legal issues. And really, she would be simply instructing the jury from the witness box as to what the law is, and then also telling the jury the defendants violated these laws. And that's improper, that usurps the role of the court. The Mamerlin case we cite, for example, where an expert was allowed to testify that a vehicle violated federal safety standards, that was held to be improper. Our case, I think, is even clearer than that. Here we have an attorney telling the jury these specific laws were violated. I think in our case, all the pitfalls which this court has mentioned in the Bamberlin case and the Harbor Insurance case exist here. The expert is telling the jury what her legal research showed, and the jury is inferring from the court that it could look to her as an expert for legal guidance in deciding the issues. And this really is what the judge is for. He is the legal expert in the courtroom. An attorney can't testify to the jury that his client's rights were violated. I think trying to label her testimony as land use or whatever else is relevant. You have to look at what her testimony is, what it was going to be, and I asked her I want to know all the opinions she was going to testify to, everything she was going to testify to, and her testimony was going to be, this is what the law is, and this is how they violate it in each and every case, and that's improper. And specifically, she was going to testify we violated the Fair Housing Amendments Act. So I think she was properly barred by the trial court. The plaintiff raises another issue regarding jury instruction, and I think the court's instructions were adequate for this case. I think they were appropriate. The instruction they tendered, in reviewing the record, I noticed that there seemed to be agreement that plaintiff's instruction 14 didn't mention anything about action being taken because of their handicap. And I think the court and counsel, frankly, agreed to that. And the plaintiff's counsel asked, well, we'll redo it and retender it. But I don't believe it was ever retendered in the revised form that they wanted to do. So consequently, I think that besides being a confusing instruction to start with, it does not properly state what the law is and was properly barred. I would point out that, for example, the instruction the court actually gave on burden of proof, the instructions 8 and 9, are identical to the ones which the plaintiff tendered, except for the part about reasonable accommodation. But that appears in the appendix at page 48, which was plaintiff's instruction number 38. And it is identical in every way to the one the court actually gave, except it did not have the reasonable accommodation language in there. I think the jury was properly instructed. This is not a reasonable accommodation case. What we did and acted the same way as anyone else who was developing property near or in the city. I think that the court's rulings are correct. The verdict should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. Ms. Whalen, your time has expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal.
Very brief. The fallacy, I think, a defendant's argument is that they would have done the same thing to anyone else, is that this is a protected class, and they can't do it. We're not just anyone else. It's the disabled are a protected class under the handicap. This isn't Wendy's. Wendy's can't ask for a reasonable accommodation, but the disabled is. And again, their argument that the reasonable accommodation requires a showing of intent is not the law. It's a separate element of the Fair Housing Act. The Metro Arlington Heights case said that everything a city does applies to the in denying this action applies to the disabled, and this is an ad hoc, irrational decision that denied these men the right.
Well,
to
what if the property owned by the Jehovah's Witness, the property to the north owned by the Jehovah's Witness, suppose you had an opportunity to purchase that property, but the city chose to zone it commercial.
Not the city's zoning, but okay.
Well,
yeah, but okay.
Whatever the, I'm just trying to create a hypothetical where you would like to expand because of needs or projected needs, let's say 5 to 10 years out. Is that the kind of, would that be a failure to accommodate situation where the property that you had access or an option to buy on was being rezoned commercial and precluded the kind of housing that you would wish to go forward with?
Well, I think then you'd have to take it from the start to say that we would have to request an accommodation from the zoning. If there was a rational zoning plan, which is the basis, I believe, of the Brenton Hemisphere cases, you depart from there and analyze it under an analysis. Is our request reasonable? Is it unduly burdensome? That's how we would have to do. Mm-hmm. Here, we don't have that. We just have an ad hoc decision that they wanted to force us to give something away that we wanted to get compensation for.
All right. Thank you, Swann. Thanks, Martin. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will